Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I thought I'd start off with talking about the new herpes zoster or shingles vaccine. It's called Shingrix, and it's really a breakthrough. Now, the old vaccine was what we call an attenuated live virus, and that's something like the measles vaccine. And in this case, what you do is you take the virus and you subject it to an acid bath and various other chemical things, but you don't kill it. It's still potentially it can infect something. And you need that to get the immune system riled up and making antibodies. And so that's how a live attenuated vaccine works. The problem with these is, of course, it's live virus. And so if you give it to a very sick person or a person who, for whatever reason, has a weak immune system, you may find that they themselves get a version of the disease. Sometimes this can be really significant. We used to give an attenuated version of polio, and very rarely somebody would actually, you know, give polio to somebody in the household. And so it was a big deal to avoid having this vaccine with that potential danger. And the second problem with the existing Zostrix vaccine is it doesn't work very well, and you don't get a really good version of immunity. And so about 50% of cases of zoster were prevented statistically. And since zoster is a painful illness that lasts for months and sometimes leaves you with persistent pain for years, that was still considered a win. But this new vaccine shows higher antibody levels and I think has a better chance of working. And what this one is this is an adjuvanted subunit vaccine. So I'm going to explain all of this to you. But an adjuvant is something that's added to the vaccine to make it more stimulating to the immune system. And that can be a problem because it can overstimulate the immune system. In this case, they have a recombinant glycoprotein that's on the surface of the virus, and they teach the immune system to recognize it by whipping the immune system into a frenzy with the adjuvant at the time that this is injected. And for most people, this works just fine. If you're wondering, we don't have the kind of data going out 10 years to give us that this is, you know, this percentage much better in preventing shingles. So I can't tell you that it's for sure superior, but the initial data looks pretty good. And if you've already had the old vaccine, you can still revaccinate with this and you still get a good immune response. So, and they can tell that because the immune system's making different kinds of antibodies for the two vaccines. But both of the shapes that the immune system makes from each of the vaccines does work to grab the virus and, well, essentially flag it for disposal by our immune system, which is how vaccination works in the first place. So I'm giving this one a thumbs up if you are Medicare age or if you are immune vulnerable. Let's say that you're let's say that you are very debilitated, you have a chronic disease like diabetes, this might be a good vaccine for you to get. On the other hand, this is a vaccine that can't be transmitted to others, so that means that, for example, grandparents who get this vaccine don't have to worry about giving chickenpox to their grandchildren, which, although rare, did in fact happen on several documented cases with the old vaccine. In terms of side effects, we're looking at a pretty decent side effect profile, but just about everybody getting the vaccine has some achiness and some fatigue because you're revving up the immune system. There were increasing amounts of headaches, shivering, fever, pretty much all the stuff you'd expect if you were coming down with something. These symptoms did not last very long. and usually are gone within 48 hours in just about all cases because it's just a short-term immune reaction. And this can happen with any vaccine. And we're going to move on to our next story, and we're talking about, well, some new information about one of my favorite topics, and that's the human microbiome. As anyone who's a regular listener to this program knows, we are full of bacteria. In fact, here's a fun fact for you. About 50% of what you poop out every day is actually dead and dying bacteria, and the rest of it largely skin cells and fragments of the food you ate. But it's pretty amazing thought. We have easily 10, possibly 100 times more bacteria in our bodies and on our bodies than actually make up our bodies, and easily 50 to 100 times more DNA, because all of these bacteria have different DNA. So we're really a cornucopia of bacterial information, and much of this information is interacting with our bodies in what are proving to be fascinating ways. So today's topic is a bacteria that has gotten a lot of interest in the last couple of years. It's called Akkermansia mucinophilia. Mucin is a kind of mucus that we make in, or it's a, sorry, a protein component of the mucus that we make in our intestines. And this bacteria likes to eat our mucus, hence the mucinophilia name. It's been associated to be lower in people with obesity, diabetes, cardiac disease, and low-grade inflammation. And groups working on it have discovered that you can give this bacterium, and at least in mice, feed them what would otherwise be a diet that you'd expect to cause them to gain weight and develop diabetes, and the mice are protected from this. There apparently is a particular protein on the outer membrane of Akkermansia muciphilia, that mucinophilia, that makes a protective agent. And there's thinking that maybe this could be evolved into drug development. So what would you want to do? Well, we find that you can really increase Akkermansia by eating prebiotics. It's difficult to grow in a lab, and you won't be finding this stuff in your health food store anytime soon. But the data is looking good enough that I'm recommending that people start consuming, along with their probiotic, a prebiotic. And in the case of this particular bacterium, we're talking about something called inulin. This is a specific kind of starch that isn't broken down by our bodies, so we don't get to eat it, but it's the absolute preferred chow for this Akkermansia. And they found that when you increase your Akkermansia, you get less inflammation. There's actually a compound in this bacteria that fits into the endocannabinoid receptors, so it could act like cannabidiol, CBD, a little bit in the gut. It also improves gut barrier functioning, and it improves glucose regulation. We've got all kinds of data, both in human and mice. And interestingly enough, Akkermansia is found in human breast milk. And that's super, super important, because if it's in mother's milk, you can bet that evolution thinks it's important. So let's go to some email. All right, let's start out with Shaul. Shaul in Israel. And he writes, "Dear Dr. Don, I'm a male, 71 years old, and I've started having heartburn. So I tried Gaviscon, which helps. What's your opinion about Gaviscon?" And then he quotes one of my articles that you'll find on that website, to Ask Dr. Don, in the resources page, about avoiding heartburn and reflux and getting off proton pump inhibitors. And this is a protocol that has been established through years of clinical work. I'm sure that there are other good protocols, but this is one that I can vouch for. I know it works. And if you've been on proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole or one of the others for more than a year, you can sometimes have a terrible time getting off these agents and effectively be trapped on an agent that we know over the long term contributes to osteoporosis, neuropathy, and dementia. Not so good. Let's see if we can't get you back to normal. What is Gaviscon? Gaviscon is an anti-acid. And so when you start to have leakage from your stomach into your esophagus after a meal, you get a burning sensation because the esophagus has nerves that respond to acid. The stomach is coated with a ton of mucus, and so it does not respond to acid unless the acid levels are very high on most normal situations. So if your stomach is responding to its own acid or to, let's say, orange juice, then you've got a problem in your stomach that's causing it to be raw. On the other hand, your esophagus can be already irritated just by the normal amount of acid that would be required to digest a meal, or in some cases, even lower amounts of acid if it's already sore. So we know from Shaul's question that he's got a problem with the door at the top of the stomach. This is called the lower esophageal sphincter, and it's supposed to seal tight so that when the stomach starts dancing around to digest the food like a washing machine, none of the water, or in this case, acidy goo, escapes across that barrier into the esophagus. So if you take Gaviscon, you're dropping some anti-acid into the stomach, and it's got a bubbling agent in it that causes it to sit on the surface of that goo so that when you do get a reflux event, the reflux carries this antacid up and sort of neutralizes primarily the acid at the top of the stomach. So it's going to impair your digestion a little bit because your digestion depends on acid, but since it's going to float on the surface, it's less damaging to your digestion than the other antacids and certainly than the proton pump inhibitors. But let me ask you a question. If you cut yourself, you apply a Band-Aid on the cut and go on. But the best way to deal with this is not to just keep swallowing Band-Aid, Shaul, but to stop cutting yourself. And so a lot of that other advice that I have there about avoiding heartburn and reflux is really stuff that you could be doing. And you had a further question. This was a second email, but we put them together. You also said, don't mix solids with liquids. I'm not sure I understand it. And what I'm talking about is when you're having problems with heartburn, it's not the greatest time to eat soup because you're probably going to have much more liquid in your stomach and you're going to have more reflux. If you're having a problem with heartburn, don't drink a glass of water with your meal. Don't drink a glass of water for, call it 45 minutes before the meal or 45 minutes after the meal. You want to give the food a chance to digest and get through its agitation cycle, if we're going to use the washing machine metaphor, and then you're going to do something about it, not before. Our next email is on the same vein a little bit. This comes from Peggy in Monterey, and Peggy writes, erosive esophagitis. Listen to your recent radio talk show on Barrett's esophagus. Husband has erosive esophagitis from nonsteroidals given when he was on a blood thinner. That's a little confusing since they're usually contraindicated, but not germane. Started last spring, but it still hasn't healed. The gastroenterologist put him on pantoprazole, another proton pump inhibitor, for a month, didn't heal, so now he's on 40 milligrams twice a day. Standard gastrointestinal playbook, not working, double the dose. I think this could be extremely dangerous. He's 80. Is the problem really too much acid? Webb offers something called Acid Relief 360 with DGL, aloe vera, and slippery elm. These are all mucus substitutes that sort of coat the stomach and coat the esophagus a little bit, and they are helpful. That's my parenthetical statement. How risky would it be to try this instead of the proton pump inhibitor? Well, Peggy, it would be risky to just rely on this product alone. It's not strong enough, and if you're still having symptoms on a truly maximal dose, 80 milligrams twice a day, then something else besides acid is driving this erosion. And my bet is food sensitivity. It turns out that if you go back in the medical literature, you'll find these cases of non-responsive problems, and you find them in young children, and you find them in elders, non-responsive to proton pump inhibitors, which were really, you know, the angels sang when these drugs came out because they worked so well at stopping the symptoms. But when you're unresponsive, you have to ask yourself, I guess it's not acid. And food sensitivity can cause the formation of antibodies, IgE and IgG. And these do show up. A biopsy of the esophagus may turn out up eosinophils. And if you look up eosinophilic esophagitis in the medical literature, you'll find that they talk about food sensitivities and allergies in reference to that. But they still haven't closed the circle on the IgG sensitivity, which also can drive erosive esophagitis. So he needs food sensitivity testing. He needs to have antibodies run to see whether he's making IgG or IgE against foods. He needs to eliminate these foods. And at 80, he's going to need some help. So my recommendation, Peggy, is that you actually come and see me for this, because it's one of those things that you're going to need some guidance on getting it right, and pulling supplements off the web in a situation like this might work, but in someone at that age, I think it's pretty risky. So I hope I'll hear from you at my office. Next email, and this from Elizabeth in Maryland. Any insights about thrombocytosis? I've listened to your show forever and so appreciate your dedication to educating us all out here in Radioland. A friend, 74-year-old female with a history of irritable bowel syndrome, has recently been diagnosed and treated for thrombocytosis. Her platelet count was around 900,000. That's more than double normal, folks. It means that you're high likelihood to have a blood clot. She has been put on hydroxyurea after some bone marrow biopsy. Can you share any wisdom that from a functional medicine point of view? Well, yes, I can, Elizabeth. There are a number of conditions. Thrombocytosis is one of them. MGUS is another. Megaloblastosis is another. And these are all cases of the programming of the bone marrow getting a little bit off, and us not being able to get the right programming running again. So the cells remind me a little bit of that section in Fantasia where the sorcerer's apprentice chops up the broom, and then now he has a whole bunch of brooms making, carrying the water, and he ends up getting floated away by all of the water there. That particular situation is a feed-forward loop, and we see these in the bone marrow. They're not cancer, but they are similar in that they're caused by epigenetic shifts in the DNA. And one of the most common causes of epigenetic shifts is impaired methylation. Methyl is a CH3 group. So if you think about methyl alcohol, that's the one that makes you go blind. If you've got a still, you don't want to be drinking your methyl alcohol. It would be helpful for your friend to get tested for mutations in her methylation. And there's one, MTHFR, that's so common that about 10% of the population have at least one copy of this mutation. And it can definitely lead to trouble. So my encouragement is ask her doctor to test her for that. And if that can't happen or that comes back normal, you might still go after looking at something called homocysteine. And if that's off, then you can increase her methylation by giving her a special kind of B vitamins that are already pre-methylated. And so that would be methylfolate and methylcobalamin. So both the B12 and the folic acid should have methyl groups already on them. This can be found in a lot of health food stores. They've got multivitamins that already do this with the B vitamins. So that's what I recommend you give a try to. Our next email is from Aaron in Indiana. I've spent a couple of weeks researching the MTHFR mutation. I recently discovered I'm heterozygous for both 1298C and 677T. I remember listening to one of your shows in which caller asked specifically several questions about it. I've been to Dr. Jill's site along with Google Scholar and numerous other sites. There's a lot of information out there and a lot of unknowns. It's difficult to know what to do if one's dealing with the variant of this disease. At this point, I'm turning to you. I'm 52-year-old female in otherwise good health, although recently I've had unexplained burning in several joints the day after yoga or other fairly minor work in the yard. It would be nice to get rid of that. My BMI is about 20. That means she's thin. I eat a very good diet with lots of whole foods, greens, and produce. I take fish oil, turmeric, vitamin D, vitamin E, and a multivitamin. According to my research, I may only have 50 to 60% of the ability to metabolize folate. Apparently, those of us with these mutations have more trouble eliminating toxins as well. Well, people with these mutations also have more problems methylating their DNA, more problems making neurotransmitters with substantially higher risks of depression. They also have more cancer and more heart disease. So, yuck, this is not a mutation you want to have. So here's her lab tests. Homocysteine 9.4, and the range in her lab is less than 4. Folic acid's 22. The range for the lab is greater than 5. And B12, 584 in the reference range. So let's be clear. Her folic acid in her blood is really, really high. If normal is greater than 5 and you're at 22, you got to ask yourself, is there such a thing as too much of a good thing? And in the case of folic acid, there definitely is. Also, her homocysteine is 9.4. That's in the reference range, but the reference range is based on heart disease, on people who have a heart attack and don't have any risk factors, but they have a homocysteine of, say, 11 or 15, and so that's deemed to be, at those levels, a blood vessel irritant and something that can lead to heart attack. But normal's not good in the case of homocysteine because, as I said, 10% of the population's walking around out there with a mutation which will cause their homocysteine to be higher. Optimal is what you want to shoot for there, and optimal is probably less than 6. So you've got a little work to do, Aaron from Indiana, to get it down there. So what do we do? In terms of your folic acid in your blood, it's not getting used. What can we do? Well, for one thing, we can change your intake and make sure that you're taking folic acid in the methylfolate form or in the food form, but not in the form of folic acid that comes in multivitamins because you can't process it. And high levels of that in your bloodstream, at least in one study, have been associated with increased risk of cancers. And I think that it's toxic when it doesn't get processed. But that's an opinion, and I don't think anyone has established the mechanism for that or proved that that's why. And obviously there are other variables. So how much of your folic acid level is inactive is one of the questions that you want to ask. And the answer is quite a bit of it, because your levels are 22, so you're not getting that methylfolate. And I wish that I could find a test for red blood cell methylfolate to see what was actually getting into the cells, but I haven't seen that. What I did find in researching it is that the red blood cell methylfolate is quite variable, particularly in people with this mutation. And that probably has to do with the fact of whether or not they have other mutations that are getting in the way of them compensating for this through a number of pathways that I won't go into. So it's really important, if you have these mutations, to figure it out and not to take a lot of folic acid supplementation, but to take methylated folate. And a dose for most people will be about 800 micrograms, and that was also one of Aaron's questions. There is very high dose methylfolate out there, because you remember what I said about neurotransmitters. Well, it turns out that if you can't make your serotonin and your dopamine, and you have other problems with various common mutations, you've got a much higher risk of depression. And in fact, the standard drugs we use, serotonin reuptake inhibitors that prevent your cells from breaking down serotonin as well as they ordinarily would, don't work at all, because the problem is that the serotonin isn't getting made in the first place. So no matter how much you inhibit its reuptake, it can never get to the levels it needs to be to really modulate the emotions properly. It's out of balance. Years ago, the FDA approved high-dose methylfolate, 15 milligrams, in the form of an agent called Deplin. And this was approved for treatment-resistant depression, people who had tried three or more different antidepressants and were still depressed. And in a percentage of that population, it worked beautifully. And then in another percentage of people who try it, because of course, because it's a vitamin, you can go out and buy on the street or on the net 15 milligrams of methylfolate and take it. But you may want to think twice, because agitation and anxiety and insomnia, if the wrong person takes this stuff, are going to be big, big problems. And you really don't know at this point, even with 23andMe and, you know, looking at all of the known methylation defects, it's one of these 20 different cofactor things that you just can't figure out without a supercomputer, and we aren't there yet in being able to predict this. So when people do take doses above a milligram of methylfolate, I have people work up a milligram at a time, wait a couple of days, looking for insomnia, looking for agitation. And our goal has to be clear, because sometimes we're trying to treat depression, in which case I'll go much higher. And sometimes we're just trying to get that homocysteine down to below 6, below 8, whatever goal that you've set with your physician. Now, you also mentioned that, Aaron, that you have four children, two, all of whom are double homozygous for the C677T. So that means they got a gene from you and a gene from their father. You're worried about your two young daughters because you've read they can have problems with birth control. I'm worried about your grandchildren, because those grandchildren are at much increased risk for neural tube defects. And if those mothers, those young mothers, take folic acid in their prenatal vitamin and not methylfolic acid in their prenatal vitamin, they'll think they're doing the right thing to protect their fetuses, and they won't be doing the right thing to protect their fetuses. As far as birth control concerns, I think that using low-dose birth control pills or any of the other methods would be fine. As far as the copper IUDs, there has never been any documented cases of copper toxicity from those, even in people who have a copper storage disease. So I really think that that's a non-starter and would love to see some data showing differently. I'm really glad I was able to help you, Aaron, and I hope that in the process I've educated people to understand how important this methylation issue is and how underappreciated by conventional medicine. It's something that we all need to be concerned about. But I want to emphasize that your health is not a number. It's not a lab value. And if you have a bad lab value and you've got good health and good behavior, the chances are excellent that your body is going to be able to compensate. A lot of times, what I'm doing in my practice with people is helping them figure things out so that they can compensate for these little genetic vulnerabilities. And it's lovely to know that we have a little bit more control and a little bit less of a mystery about this than we used to. So new products come out, and it's based on a lot of science. Let's see, what are they calling it? Good Idea Sparkling Waters. And it actually has, it has some juice to it, or some legs. We've been studying, you know, what could we eat before a meal that would slow down the spike in blood sugar that over time leads to diabetes and eventually burns out your insulin receptors. And so researchers have looked at things going all the way back to about 1986 when milk was shown. If you drink some milk before you eat, you reduced the sugar spike. And so researchers subsequently discovered that if you give a certain combination of amino acids, and they basically broke down the milk and discovered that it was the branch chain amino acids, that's leucine, L-threonine, isoleucine, valine, and lysine, lysine's not a branch chain amino acid, but who cares? Please do not write me about that. So now, of course, someone's created a product and might just be fine to take a teaspoon of branch chain amino acids or drink a quarter cup of milk before eating. But the idea that we can reduce hyperglycemia by our eating patterns, not just not eating starch and sugar, but also maybe trying to fool our physiology a little bit, fits right in, dovetails right well with the last topic, I think. We've got a caller. I'm going to try to get him on the air. All right, Kevin, you're on the air. Hello.
Well, hello. I rarely call. It's kind of embarrassing to call, but what the heck?
Don't be embarrassed.
You? No, I'm not embarrassed. So, yeah, let's see. The tinnitus, sometimes it'll drive you crazy, I tell you. But I'm maintaining, but I don't know what you have any suggestions on herbs or whatever for tinnitus.
Well, how's your hearing? Do you have impaired hearing?
I have impaired hearing, and I actually had a stapledectomy in one of my ears from Dominican Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a miracle, and I can hear through that one ear incredibly. And, you know, the bone and hammer were just frozen, and they, you know, cut that out and put the little wire in, and it was like a miracle. And they didn't do the other ear, but, I still, you know, it's a hard thing to live with.
Is it coming, did it get better in the ear they operated on?
You know, it's just in the middle of the head, so it's really hard to say whether it's left or right.
Okay, well, that would be a no then. All right,
yeah, okay.
So there's a couple of alternative things that I'm going to talk about with reference to tinnitus. I'm assuming that there's no neuropathy in your feet, that your nerves otherwise work pretty well.
Thanks for asking. No, I'm all good. I can walk, and I'm basically healthy. I eat a pretty healthy diet, and you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of high-pitched noise exposure, like loud rock music, as a young person, or jackhammers?
Not so much rock music, but I was involved in kind of a car racing and a lot of automobile stuff as a mechanic and stuff like that. And so there was that, and
okay. So, yeah, the way our ears work, we've actually got this very, very long, flexible layer. It looks like, almost, think of it like a tongue, if you will. Very big, very long, wrapped around itself, kind of the way you imagine a frog's tongue. And it vibrates with sound in a particular pattern, depending on the pitch of the sounds. And the places that move the most, everything's connected to a little nerve cell, and the places that move the most get injured by loud noises. And so I used to go target shooting with my dad, and my ears would ring for 2 days after that. And he should have been giving me ear protection, but you know.
Yeah, it was different back then.
It was different back then. Yeah, I got stories, but that's another. We're not going to go there. Anyway, so the damaged nerves can be the problem, and there's not much treatment for that except masking in conventional medical therapy. I have found that a lot of people respond to chiropractic manipulation of the neck. So, and I think it's because the nerves relax, the muscles relax, and
right.
it's worth a shot to do it once or twice and see if the ringing goes down. And the other thing that I've done very successfully, and I would say my success rate's about 60-40, and we usually can tell right away, is acupuncture. And what we're doing is something called a kidney bladder central cerebral treatment, and basically involves putting some needles in the ankles, in the right under the collarbone, and right in front of the ear. And you actually stimulate with a low-grade electrical current. It's about 4 hertz, and you do it for about 35, 40 minutes. And that works right away if it's going to work. And then
right,
with subs, and then it kind of fades away, and then you do it again. And over the course of the multiple treatments, it gets quieter, and it stays quieter for quite a while. And the thing that I've noticed is that my patients will get silent intervals, and they're so used to hearing the tinnitus that I have to remind them, okay, check in, every time you go to the bathroom, check in and see if you're hearing it, because it's like it becomes second nature to have the sound. And if you're not, when it starts to go away for 5 or 10 minutes and then come back, you won't notice the silent interval. But
right,
it's,
right.
I've been very impressed.
It would be a miracle to hear silence again, I tell you.
Well, obviously one can't guarantee results, but I have been, I've pretty impressed with people's response. And so,
okay, well, I'll have to come in and visit you and see what happens there.
Yeah, I'd love that. I'd love that. You can just call the office, and it will be my pleasure to try to help you.
Okay, well, I appreciate your help. Yeah, no, it's hard, because if you go online, they always say, well, there's no cure, there's no cure, there's no cure. So it's just like, oh, God.
Yeah. Oh, I know, man. And interesting, well, when I first got had my brand new shiny acupuncture needles, which would have been about 18 years ago or 20 years ago, I think it was 1998 that I got started this, I used it for all of these things that I wonder if it'll work for this. I wonder if it'll work for wound healing. This wound is broken down 6 times. Let's see if we can heal it over. Yeah, guess what? You can do it. And
no, I'm totally
so,
inaccurate.
Yeah, so I tried it for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And just applying logic. Okay, this is where the meridian goes, and la, la, la. And I've been really impressed over time with how many things they taught me in medical school were incurable, where it's incurable, by drugs and surgery. And so that makes it incurable by what we got, but it's not necessarily incurable or untreatable. So hope to see you soon.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your the words of wisdom there.
And thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Here's a cool one. If you are struggling with kidney disease, omega-3 fatty acids may actually help slow the progression of kidney disease in people with diabetes and coronary artery disease. So this study looked at people who had either heart disease or diabetes, and they gave them, 1.86 grams of EPA and 1.5 grams of DHA. Now that's a lot of fish oil. If you go down to Costco and you buy, which I don't recommend, by the way, for your fish oil, because while I recommend Costco for a lot of things, fish oil, you want small containers. The stuff goes rancid. By the time the big tub of Kirkland that you've got has reached its halfway point, the stuff that you're taking will be worse for you than nothing at all. So you want to buy small batches of good stuff. And every month, put some oil on your tongue and taste for rancidity. Anyway, back to the fish oil. This study showed a substantial improvement in the urine albumin to creatinine ratio, and the presence of albumin in the urine is one of the things we watch for kidney disease. So, interestingly enough, the group that took the high-dose fish oil over the 12 months stayed stable. In the control group, who were people at risk, they had an increase of 72% of the albumin creatinine ratio, indicating that their kidneys had continued to deteriorate. So they were able to hold it even on a substantial number, basically everybody. That's, by the way, this reaches statistical significance at a 0.00 one, which means there's one chance in a thousand that this is by chance. Pretty good odds. Actually, 17 of the patients, and let's see, there were 262 patients total. So 17, roughly 10% of the active intervention group actually improved their albumin creatinine ratio. Oh, guess what? That actually doesn't happen very often in people with renal disease. So a threefold difference is really, really important in improvement. And if you are not taking 3,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA right now, and you've got early kidney disease, and you're diabetic, or you might just want to follow the advice from this research and do something about it. We're going to go to our next caller, and that is Aaron in Felton. Aaron,
hello.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, hi. I'm okay, thank you. Yeah, let's see. I'm getting over an H. pylori bacterial gut infection.
Mm-hmm.
It's been pretty miserable, I guess, as far as like having the infection, and then even more so the antibiotics.
Yeah, the antibiotics really tear you up, don't they?
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. It caused anxiety and I would say probably unable to sleep. Definitely it almost seemed worse after the antibiotics stopped, which was about 2 weeks ago. So now I'm starting to feel a little better, and I'm usually pretty active with exercise and stuff, but it's definitely been hard to get back into it. It mm-hmm. almost feels like I can't eat enough right now.
You basically messed up your microbiome in your gut,
yeah,
and killed off a bunch of stuff, and the cravings for certain foods that you're having are the dominant bacterial forms basically calling out for substrate. Remember, I don't know if you heard earlier, I was talking about this stuff called inulin as a...
I missed that.
It causes a really favorable kind of bacteria to grow in the gut. And
okay.
So let me just give you the dose, since I think it would be a good thing for you to try. Along with some sauerkraut and maybe a little bit of yogurt or kefir every day. But inulin comes in a powder. You want to get a quarter teaspoon and just mix it in some water to start out, and work your way up over a week to maybe a teaspoon. If you go too fast, it'll give you gas.
Okay.
But it will tend to encourage the growth of the things that we want to encourage, and it's not particularly tasty, unlike fast food, wheat flour and sugar, which are extremely tasty to the things we really don't want in there.
I've definitely been having it's easy to eat breads right now, and eggs and chicken are probably, and rice have been kind of the easiest things to eat, plus a lot of greens. I've been trying to get as much kale or broccoli in me as well.
Try blending those in a blender to break down the cell walls. You'll find them a lot easier to digest, and mix a little butter or coconut oil in there, and it adds to the makes it tastier. That'll help a lot. You may not be able to do dairy for a while. Depends on whether your small intestine got really wiped and isn't making lactose, but you'll know right away if you have a lactose intolerance, because you'll fart up a storm, and it's not subtle.
That seems to be kind of lessening. What about a month ago is really the gas came on, and then almost like a fever, and then some heavy esophageal spasms, which quite scary.
That's die off. Yeah, it sucks. Okay, so any further questions, or specifically?
Those kind of pointers are perfect. I am doing some good probiotic pills, and some sauerkraut and pickles, and kefir seems to digest all right. I'd probably need to eat almost like 3 or 4 times a day, it feels like right now, as opposed to. Yeah,
and go ahead and follow your instincts there, but make sure what you select is healthy stuff that's not going to misfire for you.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Bye bye. Okay, and now one quick comment from Rory in Watsonville. Hello.
Hey, Dr. Don, thanks for taking my call. I remember when you were on KUSP years back.
Yeah. Well,
good to hear you.
Thank you. Thank you. We've only got about a minute, so go ahead.
Yeah, this will be quick. I know artichokes are a rich source of inulin.
Yes.
And that's for people that don't want to necessarily go buy the powder, maybe they just want to enjoy a nice artichoke dipped in some good butter or something. Great source as a prebiotic. The question I had for you, what was the name of the bacteria that specifically feeds on the inulin?
It's Acker. Okay, A-K-K-E-R.
Got it.
The Mancia, spelled like it sounds.
Yep.
Mucin, M-U-C-I-N. Philia. So, Phila.
Okay. I'll look it up.
Yeah, so you get five letters into that on Google. He'll find the rest of it for you.
And it's naturally, it should be in everybody's gut, is there some good probiotic that we can supplement with to make
they
sure
haven't
you got
been
it
able,
going?
They haven't been able to grow it yet. So
okay.
We might get there, but not there yet.
Okay. All right. Dr. Don, thanks for your show. Always good to listen and learn.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.